Jesus, I come before you, and I thank you for your word. I thank you that your word is living and active, as it says in Hebrews, sharper than a double-edged sword, that your word pierces and even divides soul and spirit, that your word convicts us of sin, and it is also the means you use to bring spiritual life and to bring spiritual healing. I thank you for the great number of marriages and individuals who have taken large steps of spiritual growth in their marriage and in their sexuality and in their purity during this series. I thank you for the multiple marriages that were weeks ago teetering on the edge of divorce that today are together and are trying to work things out and are trying to please Jesus in that area, and that, Lord, you are transforming the individuals. We thank you for that. I thank you for the folks who have been struggling with things like internet pornography and who have decided to come clean with it and who have repented and asked help and accountability. Lord, we thank you for the good things that are happening. Thank you also for the husbands who have taken wives on dates and the excitement of Valentine's Day this week and a chance to be able to serve our spouse. Lord, I ask that this morning as we get into thought lives and dreaming and fantasizing, and we ask that you would help our very inner worlds to be honoring and pleasing to you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I'd like to welcome you. And if you're new, my name is Kurt. I am one of the pastors. We are currently preaching through the Song of Solomon. This is our sixth week in this little-known Old Testament book. And if you were with us last week, you know that we went through sort of a flashback. What the series was last week in the second half of chapter 2, the Shulamite gives a sort of flashback of a time when her and Solomon were dating. And he had come out to the hillside of Lebanon to go for a walk in the country with her, to talk and to relate and to build their relationship up. And this is good because while he is very motivated and he is very positive about their relationship, she, on the other hand, while she loves him, is more realistic and cautious about that relationship. And she sort of playfully says to him that we need to catch the foxes that are let loose in our vineyard. And we wondered, what does that mean? But in her context, being that she grew up in a farming family that was a vineyard-growing family, little foxes were the small animals that would get into your vineyards and burrow in among the roots, loosening the soil. And then you wouldn't have a good harvest. And then these same foxes would also eat the grapes when they began to come on the vine. So these little pesky creatures could seriously destroy your farm. They were little problems that had to be addressed before they caused big difficulties. And that's what she's saying with him. She says, Solomon, we have to address some little issues now, but if we don't address them now, they're going to turn into a marital disaster down the road. Now, we didn't go into what was the specific issue that she wanted to talk to him about last week. We're going to do that this morning. But I'm going to tell you, she addresses this in a very different way. She addresses it by telling him of a recurring dream she is having. Essentially, it is a nightmare she is going through. Let me read it to you here in the very beginning. We know this is a nightmare. She says, "On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves." The picture is she's asleep, she's laying in bed, it's at night, and by the way, it's nights plural actually in the Hebrew, so this is a recurring nightmare in her mind. It's a recurring nightmare of what may happen down the road in their relationship when they get married. Now, before we look at what this nightmare is, I want to spend a few minutes talking about thought life, talking about dream life, and talking about our fantasies, because this will be the umbrella that we unfold this text under. So let's look at the first point. I'll give it to you right up front. It's guard your thought life. In many churches today, Christians have a serious disconnect. They think that God is very concerned with their actual life and what they do with their hands and what they speak with their mouth. And while that is true, God is very concerned with our actions. The disconnect comes is that many people think that God is not concerned with our thought life. That our thought life and what we think is a domain that is ourselves, and that nobody has a right to tell us what we should think, what we should ponder, and what we should dream about. And here's the problem. There is a good connection, a very strong connection we're going to see between what we think in our mind and what we do in our life. And to pretend that that connection does not exist is simply foolish. Now, if you read secular marriage books, and I'm not recommending this, by the way, because I saw people in the first service starting to write this down as actually this was the main point. It wasn't. But if you read secular marriage books, they will tell you to spice up your married life by having a great fantasy life. In fact, they tell you to fantasize about a relationship with somebody who is not your spouse. Because will it work you up, probably? Will it get your motor running? I would assume so. But is it pleasing to God? Absolutely not. And many people respond, well, why? We didn't actually do anything wrong. Yeah, but you role-played it in your mind. And is it sinful? Yes. Okay, ladies, I want to talk to you about this. Because, ladies, many of you are involved in a sort of a fantasy relationship side. It's called romance novels. You love to read the romance novels and fantasize about you being involved in that relationship vicariously. Sometimes you're involved in the daytime television or the soap operas. And what do? You're fantasizing about being involved and connected into that relationship. It's wrong. Well, you haven't done anything wrong in actual life, but you've done it wrong in your mind. And guys, we are guilty of this, but in a little different way. Guys typically don't fantasize about a relationship. We fantasize about another person, or you fantasize about another woman and her body and who she is. Now, you haven't necessarily done anything wrong in the one sense that you haven't maybe been with that other person, but have you done something wrong in your mind? Yes. Here's the thing. Your fantasies are only one step removed from your realities. What you role play in your mind will eventually become what you real play in your life. Your thought life is highly determinative of your real life. What you think is very important because it will become what you eventually do. And to say there's a hard separation between the two is not right. There is a soft separation between the two. Think about this not just in terms of sexuality, but think about this in terms of conflict. Have you ever been in a conflict with someone else and you disagree with them and you're really worked up about it and you're really angry about it? And what do you do in your mind? You sit there and you role play and you think of all the great one-liners and all the great comebacks and all the great things you're going to say just to put them right back in their place. Is that right? Or is it wrong? Or is it a sinful fantasy? Would Jesus Christ be glorified in your life if he was looking at your fantasy responses? Now, ladies, I want to talk to you about something. You want to have an affair? You want to be able to cheat on your husband? Let me tell you how this works. When you're around some other guy, you begin to start spending time with him. You begin to start enjoying his presence with him. You begin to start thinking about him when your mind goes into idle. You begin to start sharing with him that are more things that are more intimate and necessarily a little more personal. You wouldn't share with everybody. And then you say, well, I haven't done anything wrong. But you have greased the skids, so to speak, to do something wrong. And when that guy turns around and he starts to express interest in you, you slide right into an affair faster than a greased pig. Well, why? Because what you role play in your mind will eventually become what you real play in your life. Now, guys, let's talk about our language. Have there ever been times where your wife has maybe done something that has totally, completely irritated you? And you bit your lip. I didn't call her a flaming idiot. You're thinking, look at a great guy I am. I didn't say it, but boy, did I think it. In fact, you should have seen all the things I was thinking about saying that I didn't say to her. And you're all proud of yourself about it. But here's the problem. When you keep thinking it, when you keep entertaining it, what happens the next time something happens in your marriage? What comes out of your mouth is what you have been thinking about again and again in your mind. It just blurts right out. You will say it eventually, because what you role play in your mind will become what you real play in your life. Say it with me. What you role play in your mind will become in your life. Remember that. Your mind is highly determinative of what will happen in your marriage and what will happen in your relationship with others. Now, what does the scripture say in this regard? 2 Corinthians 10:5 says this, "We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ." When I read this, I picture a little calf roping. You know how the calf gets out and the horse guy goes out with the lasso and he has to tie up the calf before it gets away? This is like our thought life. The thought gets out of the corral. We have to go lasso this thought up and tie it up before it gets away. And some of you are like, calf roping is easier. Well, maybe for you guys, it's bull roping. It's harder to get that thought life under control. But either way, our thought lives have to be brought into control under Christ. The scriptures say in Ephesians 4, 26 and 27, "Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity to the devil." Has anybody ever gone to bed angry with their spouse? Just me. Nobody else? You know, honesty is good. Okay, every hand should be up for people who are married here. That's right. Some people have two hands up, okay? All right. But the truth is, you ever have this happen where you go to bed and you're irritated with your spouse, and on a scale of 1 to 10, it's sort of a level 3 irritation. And as you're laying in bed and they're nice falling asleep next to you, the more you think about it, it goes from a 3 and your imagination raises it up to sort of a 5. Within 20 minutes later, it's up to a 7. And another half hour later, you're like 9.5 on the Richter scale, where 10 is the highest, and you are just seething with anger, and your imagination has brought it to the fact that your spouse is just the terrible, most worst person ever, the most mean-hearted, terrible person you could think of. And this has happened to me. And, you know, you get so frustrated, and for me, this is what I end up doing. I end up getting out of bed. I can't even stand to be next to my wife, and I would go lay on the couch. Now, let me just tell you what a great wife I have, because usually at that time, within about 10 minutes, she comes out of the bedroom looking like this, like, "What are you doing out there?" And to which case, I tell her, "I am so angry. What you said was so insensitive and so hurtful." And she just looks at me and goes, "Oh, get over it and come to bed." because it was totally blown out of proportion. By what? The imagination. The mind. Now look what it says here. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. In other words, solve it before you go to bed. And give no opportunity to the devil. When you go to bed angry, you're giving the devil an opportunity to put his foot into your life. Because your imagination will extrapolate it and expand it to be much worse than it originally was. So don't go to bed angry. The mind is extremely powerful to determine what happens in your marriage. Now, let's go ahead and look at what is going on in this young woman's dream and what is going on in her mind. First of all, we know she's having this recurring nightmare. And here's what the nightmare is. We've learned she is a very simple country girl who grew up in the vineyards in Lebanon, small farming family. However, she is engaged, if you want to say, and looking at getting married to a very complex city boy, Solomon, the guy who's going to be king. And here's what she is concerned with. Will his kingly life take over his home life? It's not going to be like the kind of home she grew up in. Not at all. I mean, she grew up with mom working around the kitchen in a rustic house. She becomes the queen. It's going to be all painted nails, no kitchen time at all. Much more complex social interactions. It's going to be a very different life for her. And she says, I'm not too sure I can handle this. That is the fox she is wrestling with in her life. Now, let's go ahead and look at this in the top of page 2. The lessons from her dream. Let's look at the first 2 verses here. On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. Remember, this is a dream. She is not married to him yet. She is imagining that she is married to him, and she's the queen, and she's in the city, and she's imagining that she's home at night, and she's by herself. We don't know what has happened. Maybe she had a romantic evening plan, and he didn't show up because he was late at the office. You know, there is no Verizon yet. There is no text messaging teenagers. It doesn't exist. She doesn't know where he is, maybe why he hasn't come home. Maybe she had another evening where she had the special dinner and she's eating it by herself again. So finally, he still hasn't come home, so she's in bed waiting for him, rolling her fingers, wondering when he's going to come home, and she can't handle it anymore. So what does she do? She gets up and she's going to start looking for him. Now, ladies, I want you to put yourself into her situation. What kind of emotions would you begin to feel at this point when he is out late at night again? Anger? Maybe would you begin to feel resentment towards him? Resentment towards his job? Would your mind maybe even begin to wonder if there's another woman that's caught his eye? Could you begin to see how your imagination would so quickly begin to weave a tapestry of insults and anger that you cannot wait to unleash upon him when he finally walks through the door at 12:30 at night? Can you understand how you would think that and how you would feel that? This is what I love about this lady. Rather than sit there and breeding and trying to work on a great whole line of insults and hurts to get even with him, what does she do? She puts on her pink bathrobe and her pink fuzzy slippers, and she is going to go hunt him down and find him. If you have your notes, circle these words. Line 1, I sought him. Circle sought. Then I sought him again, circle sought. I will rise now, circle rise. I will go, circle go. I will seek, I will see, circle that. I sought him. You see a recurrent theme here? She is what I call a solution-centered woman, not a problem-centered woman. This is very easy in a marriage to become a problem-centered person, not a solution-centered person. She is not going to sit here and just breed all kinds of insults and injury. She is going to go hunt him down and tell him she loves him, she misses him, and he matters. That is what she's going to do. In fact, here is your simple application that you can apply this week for your homework. Be a solution-centered, not problem-centered couple. A problem-centered couple is when there's difficulty in the relationship, all you do is you just sort of just gripe about the problem. A solution-centered couple says when there's difficulty in the relationship, let's go work on a solution. Well, what do you want? To gripe about the problem or to find a solution? She finds a solution. Now, let me talk about this. What does it look like? Number one, avoid problem-centered whining. Now, I know you just said whining in church, but that's sort of what it is. There is people that are problem-centered whiners. Let me tell you what this looks like. Number one, it's called verbal vomit. Now, has anybody ever had your kids vomit on you? Yes, right. You're like, oh, I don't even want to touch it. You're like, oh, I got to go take a shower. I don't even want to be near them. It's like projectile vomit. Stay 6 feet away. You know, and sometimes people get that way when there's a problem in their life. What do they want to do? Vomit. Vomit verbally on everybody around them. And what does everyone want to do? Give them space. You know, and they're problem-centered. Now, some people have committed to say, I'm not going to vomit my anger on everyone else. What I'm going to do is I'm going to keep it all to myself. And instead of working on a solution, they just stuff it. They're stuffers. What they do is they're like a bicycle tire. With all their anger and emotion, they start going up to like 100 PSI. And nobody in their family even knows it. And then somebody who loves them very much just says, could you please pass the sugar? And what happens? Kaboom! It all explodes all over the place. It's a problem-centered person. Some vomit it out, some stuff it in, but it comes out eventually. Another way that problem-centered people deal with issues in their life. Sometimes they focus on developing a hobby. And these are what I call the hobby-centered people. There's an issue between a husband and wife. And rather than work on a solution for it and try and strengthen the marriage, all of a sudden one of the people takes up a hobby. And you know it because you can see it. Because all of their energy, all of their time, all of their talk becomes about what? Their hobby. It's not about the joy and thankfulness that God has given me and my spouse, but it's all about this over here. It's their car, you know, or it's their computer or what it is. Well, they're not dealing with the problem. They're just trying to transfer their affection someplace else. And sometimes you even find people that what they do is they transfer their affections to a new person. Are they still married? Yes. But all of a sudden they start developing a relationship with somebody else outside of their marriage. It may be the same sex. It may be a different sex. But the issue is they're developing a relationship over here, not solving the problems in their main relationship over there. That second one was face marriage problems and don't ignore them. That's the second issue there. What I love about this lady, she's going to go find a solution. She's not just going to whine and be problem-centered about it. Next thing we find, put our finger back in the text in verse 3. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? I tried to imagine myself in her shoes. Pink bathrobe, fuzzy pink slippers, 2 o'clock in the morning, as it were, running through the city. I'm going to find my husband. I don't know where he is. He hasn't text messaged me. He hasn't called me. I need to find him and tell him I love him and we need him at home. I think if I was her, I wouldn't want everybody to know those issues were going on in our marriage. I'd want to be a lot more closed about it. Would it be hard to find him if you don't ask anybody, if you don't talk to anybody? Yes, it would. But she's not closed about it, is she? She needs help, and she's willing to risk the public embarrassment to get it. She's going to talk to the rent-a-cops, as it were, who are working in the palace here. She doesn't care about the gossip, and this is the deal. What I find is that she is going to get help at all costs. And I thought about this. People, when they typically come into my office for marital counseling, let me just tell you at what level of conflict they come in for the most part. For the most part, they come into the office when they already have the paperwork in the process for a divorce. They should have come months earlier. They come at the very last minute. And why don't they come months earlier? Because of their pride. They can't swallow their pride and say, hey, we have an issue. We need help. Here's the challenge. When headed for disaster, swallow your pride, guys, and save the bride. Swallow your pride, save the bride. She's much more important than your pride. Homework, swallow the pride and get help. Let me give you some ideas about how to get help. Number one, faithfully attend this series, because the second half of this book, we're going to find these problems that we're talking about today that she sees in the future come to fruition. And it's going to be a lot of discussion about how to handle marital problems in the second half of this book. Number two, invest in a marriage encounter weekend. This is something we support as a church. And if you want to find out what marriage encounter weekends are available, go to the SolomonOnSex.com website and look under the message for this week, and you'll see a link there that you can click, and it'll bring you right into the Family Life Connection area, and you can choose one of the marriage encounter weekends there that fit your schedule. Here's what I want to make a commitment for you on. If you are struggling financially to get there, talk to me. I'll make sure you're paid for. Some of you are going to say, well, we have kids and I can't find babysitters. Talk to me. We will find the best babysitting people you can imagine in the church who will help you. We will let nothing hold you back. Swallow your pride, save the bride, get help, and get help early or late. Early, not late. Number three. Read helpful books, and I don't mean just anything you type into Amazon.com. Go to the SolomonOnSex.com site and look under the resource page, and I have a bunch of good resources for you there. You can read so much. I love to read. Number four, talk with a pastor and elder. One of the great benefits of this series that has been so neat, this is our sixth week into it, and I'm going to roughly say this. I have to go check my names. I started writing them down earlier in the week. There are about 14 individuals or couples that I am aware of that have taken large steps of growth, spiritual growth, in their lives because of the response to this series. We're talking about marriages getting back together. We're talking about, I mentioned earlier, about porn. We're talking about all kinds of purity issues. That's a lot. And that's just me. You know, and it's been such a privilege as pastors to encourage and to walk alongside and help folks who are getting restoration in their marriage. So, hey, that's an exciting thing. Let's go to the top of the back page. And here's what, let's see. It says, scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go. And all the guys are circling the one that says, I held him and would not let him go. And they're wondering, what should I do, Pastor, to make sure my wife holds me and will not let me go? Maybe I should work late at night, and so she comes out in her bathrobe and slippers. That's biblical. That's not exactly what I'm recommending. But what I want you to picture at this point is the moment when she finally finds him. Do you think he probably feels guilty for being out late another night? Do you think he feels guilty for maybe having missed a special dinner date with her again and again? Do you think he's sort of going like this? And do you think in her mind she has every right to unload both barrels of her verbal shotgun all over him? Oh yeah, she feels she has every right to do that because she's publicly embarrassed, running around down in her bathrobe and slippers, looking for him again. But is that what she does? Absolutely not. She gives a completely different reaction. She comes up to him, she holds him, and she won't let him go. What is this? This is the gospel in action. So many of you, when you go through a difficulty with your spouse, you try to extend mercy. What is mercy? Mercy is not giving people what they do deserve. If you get into a difficulty with your spouse, I'm not going to say what I know should be said right now. That's mercy. Grace is giving people what they don't deserve. In other words, mercy just doesn't give them the punishment they have coming. Grace is giving them something that they don't have coming. It's so much more. Instead of her just not saying, I won't even say a thing, come home now. She gives him what he doesn't deserve and just holds him close and won't let him go. This is the gospel in their relationship. And this is what I want to challenge you on. Live the gospel in your relationship. And here's the point. You actually have to turn back to the last page to take it. Use crisis to take a big step forward and not backwards. Every crisis in your marriage can either step your marriage forward or can step it backwards, depending on how you respond. Do you think the relationship took a huge step forward in this one? Yes. And we've had this in our marriage. There's the, honey, I'm sorry, but I forgot to send the taxes day. Time to take a step forward or time to take a step backwards? There's the, honey, I'm sorry, but I backed into the McDonald's sign. Hey, it happens. You can respond one of two ways on that. You can say what's coming across your mind, or you can live the gospel. You can hold her tight and say, it's okay. I'm not going to let you go. That's the gospel. Okay. And it gets a little weird, so I'm going to have to explain this next text. She holds him tight and won't let him go until I brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her who conceived me. That sounds weird. Okay, remember, it's in a dream. And in her dream, she's married to him. They're not actually married yet. It's the dream of her being married, and she's going to take him back to the family farm. Now, I've told my wife, if she ever has a dream like this, please take me to Barbados or something, not to my parents' house. Okay? That's not exactly where I would think would be the most romantic place to be. Why does she have this dream? When she gets him back to the family farm, in her mind, does she finally get him back to herself again? When she gets him back to the family farm, in her mind, is that the place of security? Is that the place of intimacy? I think it is. But I think there's even more as you peel this back a little bit. Later in the book, we learn that she has a younger sister. She has some brothers. She has a mother. But the father is not mentioned. Apparently, her father has died. When did her father die? Obviously, sometime after her younger sister, who, by the way, is not in puberty, I don't think, at the time that this is written, was born. So what you have is her growing up probably as daddy's girl. Her growing up on the family farm and her being really close to her father and her father being home every night. And it's a very simple life. And she sees her father putting his arms around her mother as she's working in the kitchen stirring the stew. And he sees her father maybe kissing her mother's neck and all the close family times going on together. And this is what she pictures in her mind what it'll be like when she finally marries the man of her dreams. But if she marries Solomon, will it be anything like that? Probably not. She won't be cooking in the kitchen. He'll be busy most nights. It won't be a simple family life. It'll be a complex royal life. And she is, you know, going back and forth. Can I handle this? Should I marry this man? Do I love him? Yes. But until we figure this out, it's not going to work when it actually comes forward in marriage. So here are some application points. Gals, prepare to shift your dreams to support your husband's calling. If you are dating a guy, ladies, you have to realize that if you marry him, you become his helpmate to the way God has called him to live. If he is a military man, expect that he will be gone for a year at a time. Expect he may not even come home. If you cannot live with that, then do not marry that man. Because when he comes home, it's not fair for you to gripe at him for the rest of your marriage. Right? You have to be able to support his calling. Secondly, let's go on the other side. Guys, be willing to sacrifice your life and invest in your wife. Obviously, Solomon will have to make some real tough choices about less social time to be home with his family time. And guys, that's if I was going to ask ladies here what they would want more of from their husbands, I'm willing to bet it is probably time. You want more time just being with him because ladies love relationship. And guys, we're project-centered. We're focus-centered. That's where we go. You know, we don't give a lot of time that way. So he's going to have to sacrifice his life to invest in his wife. Here's some practical applications. Like be home in the evenings. Now, I know this is difficult for some, and for others it's, you know, just difficult. Here's our general rule of thumb. I try to be home with my family at least 3 nights a week. And some of you are thinking, only three? If you look at Wednesday nights, we have church, Sunday nights, small group, and you know it starts to add up. In fact, you put in all the wrestling and all the other stuff, we could be gone every night of the week. So here's the line, 3 nights. If I can get more, I'm happy. If I start to go less, I'm almost guaranteeing you there's going to be problems at home because just not enough family time. Number four, give your family your full attention. And by that, I mean when you are home, actually be home. When I was first in the ministry, I discovered that you couldn't get much done around the church when you were employed there because you had to answer the phone, you had to take care of everything, not this church, but I'm talking in ministry. You had so much stuff to do that I couldn't get into long periods of uninterrupted thought, so I started to work at night at home in the basement. Who did that leave by herself 12 feet above me in the living room night after night? Your wife. Exactly. That's not fair. Not fair at all. Besides, I also discovered that you work at night, it takes a lot longer to get things done, and your quality of your work is not nearly as good. Better to go to bed early and get up really early, like 4 or 5 a.m. if you have to, and work then. So you can spend quality time with your family. Now, here's a couple other thoughts I had as I was writing this down. Television can really erode quality time with your family. Because sometimes it can just be on all the time. Just on. This is the way we've chosen to do it. We choose we're going to watch a program. We watch the program and then we turn it off. It's like we control the television. It doesn't control us. We want quality time together. Another thing, these little electronic phones and Facebooks and computer things. Now, I know from Facebook that a number of you live on Facebook. Yeah, I know how this works. The deal is when you're home with your family, be home with your family and give them your attention. We were at a wrestling meet yesterday, and we watched people at the wrestling meet, and they all have the phones, and they were at the wrestling meet, but only half of them were at the wrestling meet because the other half were Facebooking and texting the whole time they were at the wrestling meet. So, you know, when you're home, be home. Lastly here, warning, do not awaken love until it's time. And you have seen this one before. It was in chapter 2. She says to her girlfriends, and she repeats this again and again, by the way, like she's driving a nail with a hammer. When you're young, please don't get over involved before your wedding night. Save love until it's time. All right. The main issue that's going on here is thought life. The thought life can have a huge determination in your real life. What you think in your mind will determine what you do. This woman, even she's having dreams, is trying to think of how she's going to solve their marital problems, not going to be frustrating in their marital problems. Honey, do you want to come up? And we're going to do just one question because of the time this morning. Okay, here's one of your questions. And by the way, all four questions are on the website at SolomonOnSex.com to check that out. What if a job comes between a couple's love life? Well, I would say that we have experienced that, haven't we? Right off the bat with marriage, she worked a night shift, and she worked 6 in the evening to 6 in the morning. I went to school at Trinity during the day, and it was one of my first sermons I had to deliver for a homiletics class, and I talked to her on the phone, and I said, could you do me a favor when you come home from work? Could you just sit in a chair in our living room? And I had stacked up cardboard boxes, and I was going to practice delivering my first sermon. I'm going to deliver it for homiletics class, and you give me your feedback because I have to deliver it later that morning. She said, sure, I'll do that as soon as I get home from work. She came home from work. She sat down in the chair. I began the sermon, and about 2 minutes into it, she was sound asleep. So I knew either the sermon hearing had to change or the job had to change, and eventually it did. So what are some things here, honey, that we can talk about what to do when a job comes between a couple's love life?
Well, sometimes people cannot change their jobs, depending what they are. For example, people in the military, as you discussed earlier, that's something you have to work with as a couple. Sometimes you have to change jobs. Well, in my situation, I was able to change shifts. After praying about it, the company had many day positions open, and after 4 months, I was able to go to a daytime position. So we were thankful for that.
And it was so costly, too, because when she worked the 12-hour shift, she only had to work 3 days a week. So it was good money, short time, but it was just too much for the relationship. So we had to make those changes. Also, I think there are some people, by the way, we know who can have a job come between their love life, and it seems to be okay with them. There's not many of them, but we've run across them where it just seems to work for them. Not us.
Yeah. Well, that's not the norm, but many couples just should pray together. What can they do to make time just to be together? Intimacy in your relationship is very important. It just avoids problems down the road.
I think the main thing for us to point out, though, is that according to 1 Corinthians 7, if you read 1 Corinthians 7, we're not going to read it this morning, but do go at home, the Bible is very clear that it is our responsibility to serve our spouse sexually, and that that's actually a priority. And what we've found is that sometimes you get couples who have opposite jobs, and they just don't think that it's that important to try and focus on changing their jobs so they can be together more often, where it is important for a couple to be able to serve each other sexually. And that's just a priority they have to wrestle with. You had one other thing there, honey. The little pray section I thought we'd talk about.
Just definitely pray together. Bring many things to prayer. Change your schedule. You might have to go down to one income, whatever it takes to just take your relationship seriously and make that time.
One quick closing story here. When I was doing my doctoral work, people asked me what the hardest part of that doctoral work was. Was it the 173-page thesis? Nope, that was sort of fun. Was it all the other classes and readings? No, that was fun. The hardest part, quite honestly, was the 2 weeks when I would be away from my family in concentrated study from first thing in the morning all day to night, and then you'd go work in the library, and then you'd come home, and you'd be by yourself in a hotel room night after night, And it was just really hard. We could talk on the phone, but there was just that huge relational vacuum that was missing. I just found it very difficult for me. She found it very difficult for her. And so about my third year into it, we were talking about it, and I had this neat idea what I could give her for a Christmas present. And it was airline tickets to fly out to Boston, where I was doing my doctoral work, on the intervening weekend. And I said, would you like something like that? Yes, that would be the most wonderful present. If we could be together in Boston over that weekend when we had some free time. And so we did that. Now, I have to tell you, the rest of my classmates were very jealous. But it was worth every penny of it, because it was important for us to be together. And God hadn't given us peace on the previous 2 years of being apart. Not that sometimes you have to do that. Hey, I recognize that. But that's just an opportunity we had. So it's one way we tried to serve each other.
I know we're limited on time, but just remember to visit it. SolomonOnSex.com. There's more extensive answers to these questions, and hopefully that'll be helpful.
Okay. Can we pray for us? Pray for the congregation here. Dear Jesus, I thank you for this morning. Thank you for being able to put our finger in the text on chapter 3. Lord, we're reminded about the importance of our thought lives and how what we think will often determine what we do. I pray for the single folks here. I pray that you would give them purity of thought life in a very sex-saturated world. That when they find themselves being faced with sexual thoughts that they know are not pleasing, that they would substitute those thoughts by things that are pleasing to you. Not just saying no to things that are wrong, but saying yes to things that are right in their thought life. I pray for the married couples. I pray that they would have fidelity in their thoughts and their intimacies for one another. I pray that for the couples that when they get into those conflicts and it's they're laying there in bed in the evening and they're frustrated and they're angry, I pray that they would solve it, Lord, and not give the devil a foothold, allowing their imagination to extrapolate things to be a much bigger issue than it actually is. I pray that you would give people good thoughts. Thoughts about how to serve and how to honor their spouse, not thoughts about how to get even. We ask that you would help us to glorify you in our thought lives and avoid a marital disaster. We ask this all in Jesus Christ's precious name.